Chapter 10. Two thoughts occur to me, said Jack Aubrey, without taking his eye from the hole in the wall that commanded the western approaches to the island, the rain-swept waters in which the surprise might eventually appear. The one is that, by and large, taking one thing with another, I've never known any commission with so much weather in it. Not even in the horrible old Leopard. Ah, Stephen, I seem to recall such gusts, such immeasurable billows. He also remembered a remote landlocked Antarctic bay where they'd lain refitting for weeks and weeks among albatrosses, whalebirds, giant petrels, blue-eyed shags, and a variety of penguins, all of them hand-tame. The Leopard was pretty severe, said Jack, and so it was when I was amid in the Namur and we were escorting the Archangel trade. I just washed my hair in fresh water that my tie-mate and I had melted from ice, and we'd each plaited the other's pigtail. We used to wear them long, like the seamen in those days, you know, not clubbed except in action, when all hands were called to shorten sail. It was blowing hard from the nor-nor-east, with ice crystals driving thick and hard. I laid aloft to help close-reef the main topsail, and a devil of a time we had with it, the bunt perpetually blowing out to leeward, one of the lines having parted. I was on the windward yardarm. However, we did manage it in the end, and we were about to lay in when my hat flew off and I heard a great crack just behind my ear. It was my pigtail flung up against the lift. It was frozen stiff, and it had snapped off short in the middle. Upon my word, Stephen, it had absolutely snapped off short like a dry stick. They picked it up on deck, and I kept it for a girl I was fond of at that time, at the Keppel's Knob in Pompey, thinking she'd like it. But, however, she didn't. A pause. It was wet through, do you see, and so it froze. I believe I understand, said Stephen. But, my dear, are you not wandering from your subject a little? What I mean is that although other bouts may have been more extreme while they lasted for sheer weather, for sheer quantity, and I might almost say mass of weather, this commission bears the bell away. The other thing that occurred to me, he said, turning round, is that it's extremely awkward talking to a man with hair all over his face. You can't tell what he's thinking, what he really means, whether he's false or not. Sometimes people wear blue spectacles, and it's much the same. You refer to Captain Palmer, I make no doubt. Just so. This last spell, crammed in here with Martin and Coleman, and with you so indifferent, I haven't liked to speak about him. By this last spell he meant the 3 days of excessively violent storm that had kept them in the hut with scarcely an hour's intermission. The wind had now diminished to a fresh gale, and although the rain had started again, it no longer had the choking, blinding quality of the earlier deluge, and people were already creeping about the island picking up battered breadfruit, particularly the sort with large chestnut-like seeds, and coconuts, many of them broken in spite of their thick husks. Just so. I really couldn't tell what to make of him. My first notion was that what Butcher had said and what Palmer said was true, that the war was over. It didn't occur to me that an officer would tell a direct lie. Oh, come, Jack, for all love, you're an officer, and I've known you lie times without number, like Ulysses. I've seen you hang out flags stating that you were a Dutchman, a French merchant, a Spanish man of war, that you were a friend, an ally. Anything to deceive. Why, the earthly paradise would soon be with us if government, monarchical or republican, had but to give a man a commission to preserve him from lying. From pride, envy, sloth, jewel, avarice, ire, and incontinence. Jack's face, which had darkened at the word lie, cleared at that of incontinence. Thou, cried he, those are just ruse de guerre and perfectly legitimate. They're not direct lies, like saying it's peace when you know damn well it's war. That'd be like approaching an enemy under false colours, which is perfectly proper. and then firing before hauling them down and hoisting your own at the last moment, which is profoundly dishonourable. The act of a mere pirate, and one for which any man can be hanged. Perhaps it's a distinction too nice for a civilian, but I do assure you it's perfectly clear to sailors. Anyhow, I didn't think Palmer would lie, and my first idea was to carry them all to the Marquesas and set them free. The officers on parole not to serve again until exchanged if there'd been a mistake. If the treaty hadn't been ratified or something of that kind. Yet, although the capture, as I saw it, was no more than a formality, I wished to make the point right away. I don't like to go on doing the civil thing, dining to and fro and drinking together, and then saying, by the by, I must trouble you for your sword. So at this first meeting, I told him he was a prisoner of war. I said it not exactly with levity. Apart from anything else, he's a much older man, a greybeard. But with a certain obvious exaggeration, I said he shouldn't be compelled to go back with me to the ship that very night, and that his people shouldn't be handcuffed. To my astonishment, he took this seriously. And that made me begin to think perhaps there was something amiss. I remember that when I first came ashore, I had thought it strange the Norfolks weren't more pleased to see us, the war being over and we being, as it were, their rescuers. And I felt the whole thing was somehow out of tune, badly out of tune. Tell me, Jack, just how would you have expected him to reply to your statement that he was a prisoner? As I made it, I should have expected any sea officer to have replied by damning my eyes in a civil way, of course, or by clasping his hands and begging me not to confine them all in the hold, nor to flog them more than twice a day. That's to say, if he really believed it was peace. Perhaps the cetacean facetiousness I have so often noticed in the Royal Navy may not have crossed the Atlantic. And then again, if there is deceit, may it not originate in the English whaler? The Vega, after all, had every inducement to elude capture. And the Vega may have tried it too, of course. However, by this time I felt so doubtful that I didn't speak to Palmer about parole or the Marquesas or anything of that kind, because if, in fact, the war was still carrying on, I should certainly have to pen them all up. It would be gross neglect of duty not to do so. It wasn't just his solemnity that made me so doubtful, but 100 little nameless things, indeed the whole atmosphere, though his full motive escaped me. And then, on my way back to the hut, I learnt that Palmer had some Hermiones on board, quite apart from several ordinary deserters. Surely I must have told you about the Hermione, he said, seeing Stephen's blank expression. I believe not, brother. Well, perhaps I've not. It was the ugliest thing in my time, apart from the glorious end. Very briefly, it was this. A man who should never have been made post, who should never have been an officer at all, was given the Hermione, a 32-gun frigate, and he turned her into a hell afloat. In the West Indies, her crew mutinied and killed him, which some people might say was fair enough, but they also murdered the three lieutenants and the marine officer, quite horribly, the purser, the surgeon, the clerk, the boatswain, and a reefer, hunting him right through the ship. Then they carried her into La Guayara and gave her up to the Spaniards, with whom we were then at war. A hideous business from beginning to end. But sometime later the Spaniards sailed her into Puerto Cabello, and there Ned Hamilton, who had the dear surprise at that time, and a damn good crew as well, took the boats in at night and cut her out, although she was moored head and stern between two very powerful batteries, and although the Spaniards were rowing guard. His surgeon, I remember, commanded a gig, a splendid man named M'Mullen. The surprises killed a great many Spaniards, but most of the mutineers escaped. And when Spain joined us against the French, a good many of them removed to the States. Some shipped in merchantmen, which was foolish, because merchantmen are often searched, and whenever one was found, he was taken out and hanged without a hope. Their exact descriptions, tattoo marks and everything had been circulated to all the stations, and there was a thumping price on their heads. And there are some of these unfortunate men among the Norfolk's crew? Yes. One of them's offered to point out the rest if he's allowed to turn King's evidence and have the reward. Informers. Lord, the world is full of them, so it is. Well, now, this puts quite a different face upon it. Palmer has a score or so of Hermione's, as well as other deserters aboard. The other deserters are liable to be hanged if they're taken, though they may be let off with 500 lashes if they're foreigners, but for the Hermione's, it's certain death. And although they're no doubt a pretty worthless set, it is Palmer's clear duty to protect them. They're his men. Even as nominal prisoners of war, they'd have to be mustered and inspected and entered on the ship's books, and they would almost certainly be recognised and laid in irons, there to rot till they hang. But if they were merely rescued as castaways in time of peace, they could be shuffled aboard with the rest. That seems to me his reasoning. Perhaps these men are the band referred to in the ingenuous Mr. Gill's letter that we captured in the packet. I quote from memory, "My Uncle Palmer's paradise, for which we have some colonists, men who wish to live as far from their countrymen as ever can be." "May I come in?" asked Martin at the door. He had on a tarpaulin jacket, and in one streaming hand he held a barrel hoop, also covered with tarpaulin, that served as a primitive umbrella, while with the other he kept the upper part of his shirt together, his bosom being stuffed with coconuts and breadfruit. "Pray take these nuts before they fall," he said. And as Jack turned from the hole, "You haven't seen the ship yet, sir, I suppose?" "Oh, no," said Jack. "She couldn't possibly be here today. I'm only arranging my tube so as to sweep as much of the northwestern horizon as possible when the time comes."
"Would it be possible to form an estimate of how long she'll take to come back?" asked Stephen.
"There are so many factors," said Jack, "but if they were able to make just a little northing towards the end of the first day, when the extreme force of the storm had dropped, and then to have brought the wind, say, 2 points on the quarter, so as to diminish the leeway as much as possible until they could shape a course for the island after the third day, why, then I think we might start looking for them in a week. Mr. Martin, may I ask you for the jacket? I'm going to see the men."
"I met Mr. Butcher during my walk, or rather scramble," said Martin, as Captain Aubrey's steps went splashing away down the rain-soaked glade. He too possesses shoes, and he too had made his way up the stream almost to its source. "He inquired for you most earnestly, said that he was delighted with my account, and that he would attend at a moment's notice if there were any renewed pressure or discomfort. But he also spoke of the ship in a way that made me very uneasy indeed. It appears that there's a chain of reefs and submerged islands a little to the west, a chain of great length extending perhaps 100 miles, and that it is almost impossible that the surprise should not have been driven on some part of it."
"Mr. Butcher may be an excellent surgeon, but he's not a sailor."
"Perhaps not, but he reported this as the considered opinion of the Norfolk's officers."
"I should not prefer their opinion to Captain Aubrey's. He knows of these reefs. He mentioned them when we were discussing the curious tide. And yet he spoke quite confidently of the ship's return."
"Oh, I wasn't aware he knew of them. That's a great comfort to my mind, a very great comfort. I'm quite easy again. Let me tell you about my walk. I did succeed in reaching the higher, denuded ground. It was there, where the stream can be crossed as it flows over an uncomfortable bed of shattered obsidian and trachyte, that I met Mr. Butcher, who agrees that the island is obviously volcanic. And it was there that I saw what I took to be a flightless rail, though perhaps it was only wet. Wet. The whole island was soaking wet, saturated with water. Where the trees, great ferns and undergrowth stood on very steep slopes, there had been landslides, leaving the dark rock bare. And the stream that came out at the landing place was now a broad river pouring thick mud and debris into the lagoon. Jack's path took him along its left bank, strewn with tree trunks and tangled, wrecked vegetation. And on the far side he saw Captain Palmer. Jack took off his hat and called out, "Good day to you, sir." And Palmer bowed and said something about the wind backing, more rain, maybe. These acknowledgements, repeated sometimes twice a day, were all the communication they had for the ensuing week. It was a dismal week upon the whole, with a good deal of rain which kept the stream full. A week in which their hopes of fishing were disappointed. The vegetable food within easy reach had already been gathered. Most of the broken coconuts and bruised breadfruits were rapidly going bad in the damp heat, and the surprises had taken great pains to unlay cordage and spin fishing lines as quickly as they could. But the lagoon was in a state of unexampled filth, and most of its inhabitants had deserted it, though some, indeed, had been cast up dead in stinking swathes on the high-water mark. The lean grey sharks were still there, however, and they made wading and casting surprisingly dangerous, they having a way of coming into very shallow water. But in any case, casting produced nothing but floating logs, even when they righted the launch, a very heavy task, and rowed out, things weren't much better. Most of the fish they caught were snatched hook and all by the sharks, and those they managed to preserve were ill-looking, bloated, purple creatures with livid spines that Edwards, one of the whalers and an old South Sea hand, said were poisonous. The spines were poisonous, the fish unwholesome. Fishing from the reef at low tide was a little more rewarding, but this too had its drawbacks. There were broad patches of stinging coral, and many sea urchins with wicked spines that broke off short when trodden upon, piercing bare feet deep and turning bad. Two men were attacked and bitten by moray eels as they groped for clams, and a harmless-looking fish not unlike the rock cod of Juan Fernandez brought all those who ate him out in a scarlet rash accompanied by black vomit and a temporary loss of sight. While lame seamen were ten a penny, for although they were used to running about on deck barefoot, the smooth wood didn't give their soles any great toughness. They usually put on shoes to go aloft, for example, and thorns, volcanic glass and coral rocks soon wounded them. In spite of the rain, the tangled and sometimes almost impenetrable vegetation, and the spiny creeper that made walking barefoot so unpleasant, men did move about the island, however, impelled by hunger or, in one case, by fear. On Thursday, Bondon said to Jack, "That fellow Haines, sir, the Hermione's wanted to peach on his mates. He's afraid they know and are going to scrag him. Says may he come over to our side." Jack checked his first violent reply, reflected, and said, "There's nothing to prevent him making himself a shelter in the woods somewhere behind us, shifting for himself and hiding until the ship comes in." For those who had shoes, walking was less painful, of course, and Martin and Butcher met quite often. Butcher was a friendly, rather loquacious man, and during these meetings the chaplain learnt that the Norfolks had hoped for the visit of a Russian man-of-war, known to be on a cruise of exploration in the Central Pacific, or for that of one or another of the half-dozen New Bedford or Nantucket whalers fishing in these waters or passing through them. Yet since these hopes, though lively, were necessarily indefinite, they had also intended to make a boat from the wood of the wreck. A boat in which an officer and two or three of the best seamen would sail to Wahiva for help. Once the trade wind had returned to its usual steadiness, the journey, even with the long dogleg to avoid the dreaded western reefs, would be only about 400 miles. Nothing in comparison with Captain Bligh's 4,000 in this same ocean. But they had very little in the way of tools. Only a small box that some freakish wave had flung up on the reef, and the wreck had scarcely begun to break up. So far it had yielded no more than the hatches from which they'd made their almost useless fishing raft. Towards the end of the week the rain diminished. Crossing the upper part of the stream became easier, and more men from either side came into contact with one another. This led to the first trouble. Like all the other whalers, Edwards had most bitterly resented the burning of the intrepid Fox. And when he met an American, he called him a whoreson longshoreman and no seaman, a poxed nigger's bastard, and gave him a blow with the stick he was carrying. The American made no reply, but instantly kicked him in the private parts. They were separated in time by the carpenter and one of his mates, and the American withdrew, followed by cries of "Yankee poodle," and "Keep your side of the bloody stream." For the surprises felt it to be a self-evident truth that all the territory this side was theirs. It must have seemed a natural limit, since the same day a little lower down, Blakeney was chased back across the water by a tall American midshipman with a red beard, who told him that if he were found poaching on their preserves again, he'd be cut up for bait. But these incidents excited no great attention, all minds being turned to Sunday, the earliest day upon which the captain had said the ship might be seen. Most of the week's weather, though wet overhead and underfoot, had been favourable for her return, with the wind moderating and hanging a little south of southeast. And the great, all-shaking crash of the swell on the outer reef dropping to a steady, half-heard thunder. Sunday. And Jack's razor made the round of the officers, while the two surgical instruments trimmed the foremast hands. Trimmed and scraped them painfully, none being an expert shaver. That was the ship's barber's job. But the pain was endured gladly, there being a pagan notion abroad that the more they suffered, the more certainly they should see the ship. Church was rigged in the lee of the launch, with an awning spread and a reading desk run up from stretchers and a thwart lashed rather than nailed. Jack sent a note to Captain Palmer, saying that if he, his officers and men, chose to attend, they would be welcome. But Palmer declined on the grounds that few of his men belonged to the Anglican communion, and none was in a state to appear at a public ceremony. His reply was civil and well turned, however. It was necessarily verbal, since the Norfolks were as destitute of paper and pen as they were of everything else, and it was delivered by Mr. Butcher. He remained for the service, which, in spite of the lack of books, was carried through creditably to the end. The surprises ashore included five of the ship's truest and most determined singers, and the others followed them through the familiar hymns and psalms in a fine, convincing volume of sound that carried out over the lagoon and far beyond the reef. Mr. Martin didn't venture upon a sermon of his own, but turned once again to Dean Dunn, quoting directly where he could rely on his memory and paraphrasing where he could not. All those present, apart from the score or so of Americans who sat here and there on the farther bank, had heard the matter before. A very real advantage for so intensely conservative a congregation. They approved of it, they admired it, and they listened with something of that same earnestness with which their eyes searched the horizon, straining for the slightest fleck of topsails against the pure blue sky. It was odd, among so many seafaring men accustomed to the uncertainty of the ocean and the unpredictability of anything to do with a voyage, that such importance should have been attributed to this first day of Jack's forecast, as though it possessed some magical quality. Yet such was the case on both sides of the stream. And when the frigate wasn't seen that Sunday, the surprises, at least, were strangely cast down. She wasn't seen on Monday, nor Tuesday, nor Wednesday, although the weather was so good. And as the week wore on, Jack noticed that Palmer's bow grew daily less profound, until by Friday it was little more than a casual nod. A great deal can be conveyed by a salute, and no great perspicacity was called for to see that the Norfolks were perfectly aware that they outnumbered the surprises by 4-1, that every day increased their confidence and spirits, and that it would be difficult to oblige Palmer to deal with his people's share of the increasing hostility, with the isolated fights and scuffles that threatened to develop into general violence. Jack blamed himself extremely. He should have stayed in his ship. His presence on shore had done nothing more towards furthering Stephen's operation than that of any of the other officers. He behaved like an anxious old woman. Or if he'd felt absolutely obliged to go ashore to deal with Palmer, he should, in the very first place, have attended to the tide. For in spite of their partial obliteration by the hurricane, an intelligent seaman's eye could have detected the signs of its unusual period and great force in the channel. And in the second place, he should certainly have brought a party of marines, even perhaps the launch's carronade. As it was, all the weapons the surprises possessed were his sword, Blakeney's dirk and pocket pistol, and the boat hook. The seamen all had their knives, of course, but then so did most of the Norfolks.
"I fear you're grieving for the surprise, brother," said Stephen as they sat alone outside the hut looking down to the evening sea. "I trust you don't despair of our friends."
"Despair? Oh, Lord, no," cried Jack. "She's a sound, well-found, weatherly ship, and Moat has a crew of thorough-paced seamen. Even though he may not have known of that damn reef, I'm sure that when her cables parted, his first instinct would have been to keep her from going to leeward as much as ever he could. And from what I remember of the changing direction of the wind, and from all I can learn of the position of the shoal, he must have weathered its northern end. Now, what I'm afraid for is that wretched fished mizzen. Mr. Lamb's of the same opinion. How he regrets not having clapped on a double woolding while there was still time. Would the loss of the mizzen be very grave at all? Not for going before the wind, since with the breeze right aft it wears no sails, but for beating up, for turning to windward, in short, for getting back to this island, it's absolutely essential. If the fished mizzen went, then clearly the surprise would have to bear away. She would necessarily go away to the westward, and Mowat would steer for Waiheva. He could then return, however, having found a new mast. Yes, but it would take some finding, and with Lamb and his mates all here, it would take some assembling, fitting and stepping. But above all, he'd be compelled to beat up against the trade wind and the current day after day. He couldn't be here for a month.
Oh,
said Stephen, with a significant look.
Just so. The situation here is not going to remain steady for a month, nor anything like so long.
There were voices behind the hut, and although Captain Aubrey had the highest opinion of the launch's crew as shipmates and seamen, he knew they were very much given to eavesdropping. The theoretically watertight compartments of a man-of-war were pierced through and through by this universal practice, and most schemes were known to the men who were to carry them out long before the order was given, while most people's domestic affairs were also the subject of informed discussion. Certainly this had its uses, and it gave the ship something of a family quality. But in the present case, Jack didn't wish to have his views widely known, for the contacts between the two sides were not solely hostile by any means. And the more peaceable men from either ship meeting in the higher woods, the vague no-man's land beyond the rising of the stream, would often fall into conversation, particularly if they happened to be neutrals. It was a Finn, for example, who told the Surprises Pole, Jakruski, that there was a strong party led by two sea lawyers who maintained that the Norfolk's officers, having lost both their ship and their commissions, had at the same time lost their authority, and that this made discipline hard to maintain, particularly as the Norfolk's boatswain and her hard-horse first lieutenant, dreaded by all, had both been drowned. These particular voices, in fact, belonged to Martin and Butcher, who were walking down the path together. Butcher had come to call on Dr. Maturin and to convey a message to Captain Aubrey from Captain Palmer. Captain Palmer presented his best compliments and begged to remind Captain Aubrey of the agreement that the stream should mark the boundary between their territories, with the exception of the foreshore on the Surprises side of the water, which the Norfolks might traverse without let or hindrance to reach the beginning of the Eastern Reef. Captain Palmer was, however, concerned to report that a small group of his men had been turned back that morning, jeered at, and pelted with seaweed, and he trusted that Captain Aubrey would at once take the proper measures. "Pray tell Captain Palmer, with my compliments," said Jack, "that if this wasn't mere horseplay, the culprit shall be dealt with, and if he wishes he may attend or send an officer to witness punishment. In any event, you will present my expressions of regret and assurance that it will not occur again." "Now, Stephen," he said when they were alone, "let me give you an arm up towards the top of the island. There's a flat place over the black cliff that gives a splendid vista. You've not been there yet."
"By all means," said Stephen, "and on the way we may possibly catch a glimpse of Martin's flightless rail. But perhaps you will have to bring me down on your back. My legs are still miserably weak."
The flightless rail crept silently into a bush at the sound of Captain Aubrey's heavy-footed, gasping approach. But the bare volcanic platform they eventually reached did provide them with a stretch of some 30 miles of white-flecked ocean westwards and on either side, with two separate schools of whales, one to the north, the other to the south, and with a plunging view of the entire leeward side of the island, with the stream running dark and troubled into the still turbid lagoon, the white line of the reefs, and foreshortened people walking about on the sand. Mr. Lamb and two of his mates were putting the finishing touches to a little house they'd begun making for themselves the very day after that ominous Sunday when the ship didn't appear. To them, from among the trees, entered the young carpenter of the Norfolk, who called out an affable greeting.
"What cheer, mates?"
"What cheer?"
they replied in non-committal tones, putting down their tools and looking at him with a studious lack of expression.
"It might come on to blow tonight, but we've had a fine clear day so far and mustn't complain."
The Surprises didn't choose to commit themselves on that either. And after a pause, the Norfolk man went on.
"You wouldn't lend a man a sauce head, I suppose. Mine went down with a barkie."
"No, mate, I wouldn't," said Mr. Lamb. "Because why? Because, first of all, I never lend tools anyhow, and secondo, because that would be comforting the king's enemy, which is death at the yardarm, and may God have mercy on your soul, amen."
"But the war's over," cried the Norfolk. "You'd show that to the Marines, Collie," said Mr. Lamb, laying his right forefinger along the side of his nose. "I wasn't born yesterday."
"I met your mate in the woods Thursday," said the Norfolk, pointing at Henry Choles, carpenter's crew, "under a breadfruit tree. Under a breadfruit tree it was, said Charles, nodding solemnly. Which it had lost three branches as thick as the mainmast, I passed the remark at the time. And we wished one another joy of the peace, so he believes it's peace. Of course it's peace. Henry Charles is a tolerable good craftsman, and he's as honest as the day he's long, said Mr. Lamb, gazing at him objectively. But the trouble with him is he was born on the Surrey side, and not so very long ago neither. Now, young chap, this to the Norfolk, quite kindly. I was out of my time before you stopped shitting yellow, and I've never seen any set of men behave like your mates in time of peace. I reckon it's all a pack of lies to get sent home free gratis and for nothing, and to do us out of our head money. Stephen, said Jack, passing his little pocket glass, if you look steadily just this side of the horizon where I'm pointing, I believe you'll see a steadier line of white water trending away to the right. I take it to be the shoals they spoke of. A damned awkward thing to find under your lee by night. From here you'd have to steer almost due north for half a day on a breeze like this. The breeze like this was the warm, steady trade eddying about them on this sheltered platform, but singing steadily over the high ridge behind, a fine t'gallantsail wind. However, what I really meant to say was this. I intend to lengthen the launch to take her to Huaheva. It must be done fairly soon, or we shall have no launch left to lengthen. Ill-feeling is growing stronger, and when the island's stripped bare of food, it will obviously grow stronger still. I don't think Palmer has a strong hold over his men, and the Hermione's have an even greater motive for knocking us on the head than the others. Above all, now that Haynes has deserted them and they know they're detected, and every day the surprise doesn't appear makes them bolder. Why must you lengthen the launch? To get everybody in. She was loaded to the gunwales when we brought you ashore. She must be lengthened if she's to face the open sea. A long task would it be at all? Inside a week, I believe. I'll not ask, have you thought they may take it away from us when it's done, or even before? I know they wish to be away to Huaheva themselves to bring a whaler back for their friends, God forbid. It had occurred to me. I don't think their spirits are high enough to make the attempt before we start work. And then I think that if we're brisk enough, we can find means to dissuade them when it's done. No, my chief concern is victualling. Victualling for what may be quite a long voyage, since I have no instruments. As for water, we have barrels enough for a fortnight at short measure, and I hope we can still find a few hundred sound-drinking coconuts. But the question is food. Now that fishing has failed us, and I'd banked on drying them as we did at Juan Fernandez, I should like to know whether there's anything you can suggest. The pith of the tree ferns, roots, bark, pounded leaves. Sure, we did pass a little dwarvish sorts of yam on the way up. An undoubted Dioscorea. I called out to you, but you were far ahead, snorting and didn't attend. Yet they don't really thrive here any more than the land crab, alas. And I should place my chief reliance upon the shark. He may not be very palatable. His appearance cannot recommend him anywhere, but his flesh, like that of most Salations, is reasonably wholesome and nourishing. He's easily taken, and I recommend that his upper flank should be cut in long, thin strips, dried and smoked. But Stephen, said Jack, glancing towards the wreck of the Norfolk, think what they must have been feeding on. Never let us be missish, my dear. All earthly plants to some degree partake of the countless dead since Adam's time, and all the fishes of the sea share at first or second or hundredth hand in all the drowned. In any case, he added,
seeing Jack's look of distaste. "Sharks are very like robins, you know. They defend their territory with equal jealousy, and if we take ours over by the far channel, no one will be able to reproach us with anthropophagy, even at one remove." "Well," said Jack, "I'm too fat anyway. Please to show me your yams." The yams sprawled down a scree descending from the island's highest point. The path to the platform skirted the lower edge of the fall, and here Stephen showed the climbing stems and typical leaf and a single misshapen tuber that he found by turning a few stones. "They're not happy here, poor stunted things. It's not a scree they want at all, but deep, damp earth. Yet, if you were to climb, there's a fair possibility that you might find the parents of these dwarfs. A fine, prosperous stock with great stout roots growing in a long-filled crater at the top of this scree. A territory from which these miseries have overflowed. I should wait for you here, being but feeble. If you should chance upon any beetles on your way up, put them gently in your handkerchief, if you please." Stephen sat. And presently, with a beating heart and that very particular lively, fresh happiness that hadn't changed since his boyhood, he saw the flightless rail walk out onto a bare patch of ground, stretch one useless though decorative wing, scratch itself, yawn, and eventually pass on, allowing him to breathe again. Jack climbed, travelling along the edge of the scree and sampling yams every now and then. They began, if anything, even more dwarvish and misshapen, not unlike the potatoes he grew himself at home. But stimulated by the hope of Stephen's crater and the recollection of the monstrous tubers he'd seen in former times, insipid great things that would feed a boat's crew for a day, he climbed on. The top was much farther than he'd thought, and a recent deluge blocking the crater's outlet had turned it into a lake, with the no doubt enormous yams rotting under 10 feet of putrid water. But the greater height gave him an even greater expanse of ocean, and as he sat there recovering his breath, he gazed at the far western reef or chain of sunken islands. The horizon lay far beyond it now, and he had a much clearer view of its length and breadth. A most formidable shoal indeed, with never a gap or channel that he could make out. And obliging his mind to be as cold, objective, and analytical as it could be, he gauged the surprise's chances of having weathered it in the exact circumstances of that wicked night. Not as much as 1 in 3 was the answer, and his eyes filled with tears. A series of atolls far to the north was the most dangerous place, he reflected, and while he stared at it, taking in the whole naked eye field of vision, it seemed to him that he saw something dark beyond, and he reached for his glass. Dark it was. A ship it was. He lay flat, resting his telescope on a rock and covering his head with his coat against all outside light. He'd known at once that she wasn't the surprise, but it took him 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, of very careful focusing and staring to be certain that she was an American whaler steering south. She was on the western side of that immensely long shoal. If she meant to call at this island, she would have to work clean round it and then beat up. But unless the wind increased, she could easily do so in a week. He fixed the bearings in his mind and ran down the scree. "Forgive me, Stephen," he said. "I must hurry down to the camp. There's not a moment to be lost. Follow me at your own pace." "Mr. Lamb," he said in an even voice, having recovered his wind, "a word with you." They walked along the high water mark. "I wish you to lengthen the launch by 8 feet so that she may take us to Wahiva, there probably to rejoin the ship.
Can you do that with the tools and materials at your disposition?
Oh, Lord, yes, sir. We could cut some lovely natural aprons and timber heads not 50 yards from the shore. I meant at once with the wood you have. There's not a moment to lose. Why, sure, I reckon I could, but it'd mean pulling down the doctor's place straight away. He shall have a tent. But before we lengthen the boat, we must be armed. What can you turn into hangers or boarding pikes without jeopardising your work? The carpenter reflected. For hangers or cutlasses, I can't do much, seeing as how I must keep my saws. But for boarding pikes, Lord love you, sir. Laughing very cheerfully, I could arm the hosts of Midian if so desired. I toss old keg of 10-inch spikes into the boat, and Henry Choles, thinking I'd forgot, tossed in another. And your 10-inch spike, with its head flattened and given a curl on the back of the anvil, its body shaped just so, and the whole temperate cherry pink in lukewarm seawater, gives a very serviceable pike. Not Tower of London work, they may say, but when they have 6 inches of converted spike in their weems, there's little odds whether it's London work or local. Have you your forge and anvil here? No, sir, but I can soon fudge up a pair of bellows, and there are all these old black stones for our anvil. Sam Johnson, the armourer's mate that rose Bower, is just a man. He served his time to a cutler, and he's uncommon neat. Capital, capital. Then let that be put in hand at once, together with the shaping of the staves. 20'll answer very well. I have my sword. Mr. Blakeney has his dirk and a pistol. In any case, you could scarcely manage a pike. And I don't suppose Mr. Martin would think it right. We shall also need 3 shark hooks, fast to as much of the bridle chain as we can spare. Indeed, they'd better precede the pikes, and they'll give colour to the lighting of the forge. But, Mr. Lamb, let the whole thing be done as privately as possible among the trees. The launch will go a-fishing as soon as the hooks are ready, and some sort of a light frame will be required for drying and smoking about 30 stone of shark in strips. At the same time, it would be as well to make sure our casks are watertight. And I cannot impress upon you too strongly, Mr. Lamb, that there's not a moment to lose. All hands will work double tides. All hands were much shocked at this. During their weeks ashore on Old Sodbury, with little more than the formal skeleton of ship's routine maintained, and with a great deal of wandering about by themselves in the woods or on the reef in search of food, or fishing with a line from the rocks, they'd lost the habit of brisk motion and instant, unquestioning obedience. There were also still fractures from the absence of tobacco and grog. And it was with indignation and a sense of outrage that they heard their captain roaring like a bull in a bush, as Place put it, insisting that everything should be done at the double, if not triple, and even wielding a rope's end, a weapon very few had ever seen him use except on his midshipmen in the privacy of the cabin, with horrible force and accuracy. "It's like being in a prison ship," said George Abel Bower in Johnson's absence. "Only worse. Jump to it, you idle lubber. Quick's the word and sharp's the action. Damn your eyes. What's come over him, topping at the slave driver?" "Perhaps this'll pass him, mollify him," said Place, spitting towards the moderate-sized shark towing behind, pursued by its kin. "Row off all," cried Bondon, and the launch run crunching up the strand. Abel instantly leapt out and seized not the painter, but the stout line hitched round the shark's tail, with which he and half a dozen others hauled the creature from the sea, its followers rushing in so close for a last bite that they were only just awash. Axel and his mates cut the shark's head off with the carpenter's axe and looked up for approval. A fish just the size required, and hardly bitten at all. This was no time for idle gaping, they were told. This was not Bartholomew Fair. They might join Mr. Blakeney's party and run. Run, not waddle, to the northeast point of the island where there were still coconuts to be found. Any man that didn't bring back 20 had cursed the day he was born. They left at the double,
passing the forge among the trees where the bellows wheezed and the sweating armourer hammered, naked but for an apron, and they met files of worried-looking men running down from the ruins of the hut with loads of timber, while others, equally anxious, brought in faggots of pike staves, as straight and knot-free as they could find. So they spent the day, never sitting down, never merely walking, but that wasn't enough. They were divided into watches, as though they were on board, and each watch spent part of the night turning the long strips of shark's flesh on the framework by the fire, and teasing coconut fibre into oakum for caulking the lengthened boat. And it was striking to see how much their sleeping minds returned to shipboard time and its four-hour rhythm. Each watch relieved the other almost as regularly as though the bell had been struck throughout the night. It was as well that there was a watch on deck, as it were, for at 2 in the morning a curious wind got up, and for 3 or 4 hours it blew hard from the northwest, working up a heavy short sea against the swell, and endangering the fire, the unsavoury glue-smelling food, and the new pitched tents. It was a sea that drove straight into the lagoon through the two channels. It came on the flood tide, hissing far up the beach, and there wasn't a sailor who didn't know that it must work upon the wrecked frigate. The Norfolks themselves were not very early risers in general, but a little after sunrise, when the surprises were at their breakfast, a small part of them crossed the stream and hurried along the tide line on their way to the beginning of the reef. Although it was understood on both sides that they had a right of way, they didn't care to go by in the presence of many of the surprises, and their officers and most pretended not to notice them. Though two of the more friendly, the more conversable, uttered a discreet howl and gave a jerk of the thumb. Although, in fact, the wreck had not yet opened to any significant extent, and although the red-bearded midshipman reported this to Captain Palmer, more men went by in the course of the morning. But it wasn't until 11:30 that they came back, 25 or 30 of them, dragging the Norfolk's larboard head-rails and some of her forecastle planking. By this time most of the surprises were scattered about the island, engaged on various urgent tasks, and the carpenters were almost alone, busily sawing the launch in two. Though Mr. Lamb himself had retired privately into the bushes. The only other man on the beach was Haynes, a cooper by trade, who had won a kind of half-acceptance by making himself useful to Mr. Martin, and who was now attending to the very troublesome barrels. He ran away as soon as he saw the Norfolks, pursued by shouts of "Judas!" But there were no former Hermiones among the band, and they didn't pursue him for any distance. A few made as if to catch him, but only for the fun. Another group came up to the carpenters and asked them what they were doing. Commended their tools, their workmanship. Said they, too, would presently be building their own boat, now the wreck was breaking up. And talked on at some length, in spite of surly answers or none at all. Then suddenly their leader cried, "Look, look!" pointing inland. The carpenters turned their heads. The Norfolks seized a compass saw, a sheet of the launch's copper, a handful of spikes, a pair of pincers, a small auger and a rasp, and ran away laughing. It was a laughing matter for 100 yards or so. One man tripped and lost his rasp, and another threw down his awkward sheet of copper to run faster. But by the time Choles overtook the man with the compass saw, he was already among his fellow Norfolks. Choles tried to snatch the saw, but they flung him down. Choles' friends came to his help, one hitting out with a carpenter's maul, breaking an arm directly, and Mr. Lamb came running from the wood with a dozen surprises. At this, the Norfolks all drew together, wielding pieces of wood, and withdrew steadily across the water into their own territory, leaving most of their timber on the beach. The surprises had 2 carpenter's axes and an adze, and they would have gone on to recover the tools if they'd not been stopped this side of the water by an enormous cry of "Belay there!" from Captain Aubrey some way up the hill. They hurried back to him, the carpenters all talking together, calling for an instant raid with the pikemen to recover the tools. "Mr. Lamb," he asked, "how necessary are the lost tools for the immediate work in hand?" But he was obliged to shake the carpenter by the shoulder before Lamb's face, pale with fury, showed much sense, and shake him again before he made a coherent reply to the effect that the compass saw would be needed tomorrow. "Well, then," said Jack, "get on with your work until dinner time. I shall attend to the matter in the afternoon." He ate his own dinner, a discouraging piece of shark grilled and coconut for pudding, in company with Stephen and Martin. They talked in a general way about flightless birds and the colonization of remote oceanic islands, and he followed fairly well. But by far the greater part of his mind was taken up with his forthcoming interview with Palmer. This morning's incident had to be dealt with, of that there was no doubt. Anything more of this kind would lead to open bloody battle, and although with his pikemen and axes he could probably sustain it, continual open violence would delay the launching of the boat intolerably and even perhaps make it impossible. There wasn't only the lengthening, but the re-rigging, the caulking, the victualling, and a thousand other things. A final attack, an attempt at taking the launch once it was ready, that was another matter. And if it couldn't be avoided by the various stratagems he had in mind, he was reasonably confident that it could be dealt with by main force, particularly if the pikes could be kept in reserve, for the full daunting effect of surprise. What he must aim at was comparative tranquillity for 3 days, and then, before she was obviously ready, they could run her down to the beach before moonrise on Thursday night, pull out into the lagoon, lie there at a grapnel, step the masts, complete the re-rigging and the half-deck out of reach from the shore, and sail on the evening tide. The question was, how much command did Palmer have over his men? He'd lost almost all his officers, either by drowning or by being sent away in prizes. No doubt many of his best seamen, too. And he was very much alone, unseconded. How much were the former Hermione's an integral part of the Norfolk's crew? Could they draw many of the others with them? How much was Palmer influenced by his remaining officers, the surgeon and the shadowy master or lieutenant who kept so very much out of sight? These were questions whose answers he should have to read on Palmer's hairy, enigmatic face that afternoon. When dinner was finished, he took a few turns on the level sward in front of the tent and then called his coxswain. "Bondin," he said, "I'm going to see the captain of the Norfolk. Give my hat and coat a shake over the side, will you?" "Yes, sir," said Bondin, who was perfectly prepared for the visit. "Which I've put a shaving edge on your sword, taken Mr. Blakeney's pistol, drawn and dried the charges, and napped the flints. Just the thing for a cutting-out expedition, Bondin," said Jack. "But this is a genteel morning call." "Morning, my arse," muttered Bondin, shaking the captain's coat vehemently some way to leeward. "How I wish we had the carronade." He slipped the pistol into his pocket. There was already a long, thin, dangerous blade of the kind called a gully inside his belt, and a jackknife on a lanyard round his neck. Passed the hat and followed his captain. It was indeed the air of a social call that Jack gave his visit, and Palmer, A man of breeding responded with trivialities of much the same kind. But while the small talk was running its smooth, insipid course, Jack observed that the man he was speaking to had changed very much since the last interview. Palmer was obviously ill. He looked much older. He'd shrunk. He was under great tension, and Jack had the impression that he'd been quarrelling furiously within the last few hours.
"Now, sir," said Jack at last, "it seems that some of our men got into a foolish scrape this morning. I don't believe that any real harm was meant. It was the kind of horseplay that might have turned very ugly."
"It did turn very ugly. John Adams' arm was broke. Mr. Butcher's setting it right now. I'm sorry for that.
But what I meant by ugly was half a dozen men stretched out dead for a miserable compass saw. For a foolish young seaman's prank. I did manage to call my carpenters off. They had axes, you know. But it wasn't easy, and I shouldn't like to have to do it again. Perhaps you may have noticed that men ashore, if the ship is not just at hand, are never so easy to control."
"I've noticed nothing of the kind," said Palmer sharply, darting a suspicious look from under his bushy eyebrows.
"Well, I have," said Jack. "And it appears to me, Captain Palmer, that there's such a state of hostility between our men that it's like sitting in a powder magazine with a naked light. The least thing may cause an explosion. So I must beg you will give very strict orders that this dangerous sort of caper shall never be repeated. And incidentally, I must have my compass saw again. I don't suppose there was ever any intention of really stealing it." The tent wall bulged slightly in, and it was fairly clear that Palmer was in contact, either by whispering or nudging, with someone outside. "You shall have your compass saw," he said. "But I must tell you, Captain Aubrey, that I was on the point of sending for you."
"Sending for me?" said Jack, laughing.
"Oh, no, 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 nonsense. Post-captains do not send for one another, my dear sir. And if they did so far forget themselves, I must remind you that you are at least de jure my prisoner."
"Of desiring you to come, then, so that I might officially acquaint you that this island is American territory by right of first discovery, and direct you to remove to the far side of the northern reef, where your men will not hinder the recovery of the Norfolk's timbers and stores."
"I cannot accept your contention about sovereignty for a moment," said Jack. "In any event, it's a political question quite outside my competence. But as to your notion of putting a greater distance between our men, I entirely agree. You've noticed, I'm sure, that we're lengthening our boat. When the work's finished, I shall take my people so far that there will be very little likelihood of trouble. But for that, I must have my tools again."
"You shall have them," said Palmer. And he uttered a hail that began well, but died in a most pitiful quaver. "You shall have them," he muttered again, passing his hands over his eyes. Then came in a piece of sailcloth, the spikes, pincers, and compass saw, brought by the red-haired midshipman. And while Jack was making some civil remarks about his satisfaction, Palmer broke out in a strong voice, "Finally, Captain Aubrey, since you maintain that a state of war still subsists, you must be prepared to take the logical consequences of your words."
"I don't understand you, sir," said Jack. But Palmer, obviously unwell, replied only with a choking excuse and hurried out of the tent. Jack stood there for a moment in the opening, and then, asking the midshipman to send word if Mr. Butcher would like to consult Dr. Maturin, handed the tools to Bondon and took his leave.
The path from the tent to the stream was bordered with close-packed tree ferns. And in their deep shade stood men. A dozen or so on either side, and more to be guessed behind the trunks. They were silent as Jack approached. But when he passed, their voices could be heard, low and urgent, arguing. English voices.
"Scrag the bugger now!"
cried one. And a stone hit Jack's shoulder. Almost immediately, the strong, metallic Boston shouting of the midshipman echoed through the trees, and Jack walked on, crossing the stream in the usual place.
"Mr. Lamb,"
he said, coming up to the dismantled launch, "here are your tools. Ply them like a hero, and I believe we may still be afloat the day I'd reckoned on. You may have every man Jack you want to hold a plank or shape a tree nail." That evening and the next day, the launch began to take shape again. And on the Wednesday, it was fairly covered with men fitting, joining, faying, rasping and hammering under their captain's immediate eye. For by now the victualling, such as it was, had been completed. Net after net of coconuts stood ready to be loaded. The strong-smelling parched shark lay then in flat sailcloth bales, and only the water casks stood apart, still leaking badly. The boat was screened from public view by casually draped sails, and Jack thought it unlikely that the Norfolks knew just what stage they'd reached. He told Martin that although the launch would probably be ready late on Friday, he wouldn't put to sea until the next day because of the foremast jack's superstition. And this Martin had handed on in perfect good faith to Butcher. And quite apart from that, Jack felt reasonably confident that there would be no attempt at seizing the boat until dawn on Friday at the earliest, if indeed there was an attempt at all. And by then she would already have been floating out on the lagoon for some hours. But by way of precaution he had the pikes stowed close at hand, and he took a casual shot or two with the pistol to show that ammunition was there in plenty. The entire period since his remote sighting of the American whaler had been one of the most intense driving activity. But this Wednesday outdid all the rest. Although for the purpose of deceit the launch's masts were not to be stepped, a great deal of rigging could be prepared in advance. So, on this afternoon, there was not a skilled hand but was hard at work. Carpenters, riggers, sailmakers, caulkers, rope-makers, stripped to the waist and labouring under the shade of the palm fronds with such concentration that they rarely spoke. In this connection, neither the chaplain nor the surgeon could be looked upon as skilled hands, and they'd been sent with net bags to gather yams. They had most conscientiously filled their bags, but they had spent even more of their time persecuting the rail, creeping after it through bushes until it made a dash across the open part of the scree, running as fast as a partridge and leaping down a 10-foot drop with a despairing cry. Now, before going down to call on Mr. Butcher and inquire for Captain Palmer, they were resting on the high platform, lying on their backs, with their heads on the yams, gazing up at the cloud that hung over the island, perpetually torn away to leeward and perpetually renewed from the southeast. "Gamelin says that the Siberian rail sleeps buried in the snow," observed Martin.
"Where did you find that?"
"In Darwin. Speaking of the early spring flowering of Muscus Coralinus, he says, 'Down the white hills dissolving torrents pour. Green springs the turf and purple blows the flower. His torpid wing the rail exulting tries, mounts the soft gale and wantons in the skies.'" And this he justifies in a note, citing John George Gamelin as his authority.
"Sure, I honour the Gamelins, but there is something about rails that excites credulity. In my part of Ireland it is said that the land rail, the corn crake, changes into a water rail at the approach of autumn, and then turns back again in spring.
I trust Dr. Darwin didn't really believe in this hibernation. He's a respectable man. Did you ever look into his Zoonomium? I did not, but I do recall some lines from his Origin of Society that a lewd cousin of mine used often to recite. Behold, he cries, earth, ocean, air above, and hail the deities of sexual love. All forms of life shall this fond pair delight, and sex to sex the willing world unite. Do you suppose, Martin, that that is what they're doing down there on the strand? Hailing the deities, I mean. Seafaring men are wonderfully devoted to them, according to my experience. Certainly they're making a most prodigious outcry. Joyful they sound. Demented. I shall look over the edge, said Stephen, getting up. Oh, my God, he cried, for there, on his left hand, not 2 miles from the shore, was an American whaler. She'd rounded the southern headland, and she was in full view of the shore, which was crowded with Norfolks, roaring and cheering, quite beside themselves. The red-headed midshipman and another youth had already raced out along the reef with incredible speed to warn her of the dangerous passage with the wreck across it. Some were running aimlessly up and down, bellowing and waving, but a score of men, a tight, eager pack, were after Haines in his red-checked shirt. He dodged among the barrels, among the heaps of firewood, among the stores. He was headed off from the shelter of the trees, headed off from the launch, and hunted fast along the sea. They brought him down at the edge of the stream, disemboweled him, and threw him into the water. Yet far the greater number swarmed round the boat, which the surprises were desperately trying to push down to the hard sand and the sea. Some snatched away the slides, others flung her precious stores about or staved the water casks with great stones in a mad destruction, and others, perfectly without fear of the pikes or anything else, tripped up the men who were shoving or threw whatever came to hand on the high water mark, seaweed, driftwood, lumps of coral, or even push in the other direction. Some had been put out of action. Jack's sword arm was red to the elbow, but it had no effect. And presently the launch was hopelessly deep in dry sand. Once this was so, once escape was impossible, the attackers drew off to line the sea and cheer their long-awaited whaler. All the surprises were now inside the boat, which bristled with pikes, an impregnable stronghold for the time being, but for how long a time? Stephen's heart was big to bursting with the violence of his grief. Yet even as he looked distractedly from side to side, his mind told him that there was something amiss, the more so as the cheering had now almost entirely died away. The whaler had a huge spread of canvas aboard, far too great a press of sail for her possibly to enter the lagoon. She was tearing along with a great bow wave, and she sped past the mouth of the farther channel. A cable's length beyond the opening, her main and fore-to-gallant masts carried clean away as though brought down by a shot, and she instantly hauled to the wind, striking her colours as she did so. Her pursuer came racing into sight round the southern cape, stunsails aloft and alow on either side. A dead silence for the motionless Norfolks below. Fired a full, prodigal broadside to leeward, lowered down a boat, and began to reduce sail, cheering like a ship clean out of her mind with delight. "She's the surprise," said Stephen, and he whispered, "The joyful surprise. God and Mary be with her."
The End. You've been listening to The Far Side of the World by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.